Day Player on 720 WGN. So from the man who wrote the songs that outsold the Beatles and the Rolling Stones in the late 60s comes a story of the first decades of his life in Hollywood, New York. Immerse yourself in Grammy, Golden Globe, and Academy Award-nominated songwriter Bobby Hart's world as he shares the story behind his success from humble beginnings and comes a musical Goliath. Now, Bobby's got a new book out called Psychedelic Bubblegum, and it's a vivid narrative that follows his gradual rise in the music industry as half the duo Boyce and Hart, as he and his friend and partner Tommy Boyce wrote the songs that launched the Monkees to stardom, including their very first hit, The Last Train to Clarksville, and eventually reaching over 100 million in sales. And joining us tonight to tell his story is Bobby Hart. Good evening to you, Bobby.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
I am fantastic. I am thrilled that you're spending time with us tonight.
That's my pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, you have had an incredible journey. And what was the process like to look back at this amazing career like you've had and put pen to paper and write this book?
It was a wonderful experience. It took a long time, and it was a kind of a labor of love. But you find that you see things, you know, when you're writing it all down and trying to piece together all the memories of the years that you don't see as you're living life day to day. You see patterns, and you see mistakes that you made, the things you could have done better, and you see things that you did right. And you can see, for me, that's what I was looking at, and that's why it became more of a book about spiritual journey. Of course, all the music stuff is in there, but because I could see, I could see those patterns, and I was at one point feeling like I had kind of an obligation to pass some of this knowledge on.
You know, it's funny because, as you said, you know, it's never methodical when you're living the life that you live. But when you look at it and you chronicle everything that has happened to you, sometimes you do find a pattern and say, "Well, wow, that's how I got from step A to B."
Exactly, yeah. And if somebody else can be helped from that, you know, that would be wonderful at this stage of my life.
Sure. Well, when you were a kid, I know you looked up to country music stars and DJs on the radio. I know Ray Odom was one of them, and they really
Ray Odom.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know of him. No, I do. Yeah. I know of him from the Radio Hall of Fame. But you know, you looked up to these guys and said, "These guys are cool. I want to be just like them."
Yeah. No, he was great. I listened to country music pretty much exclusively during my childhood because I would listen to pop, what they were calling popular music, but it was a different era, and it was right after the big band stuff, and it was the I don't want to pin it all on Sinatra, but it was that kind of music, you know.
Yeah.
And I became a big fan of Sinatra later on, but some of those other singers in that day just didn't get it for me, so I listened to country. And the number one station in Phoenix where I grew up was country, was the KHEP, and it was Ray Odom, and I thought, wow, this guy is cool.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
That's what I thought I would be. I planned to be a disc jockey.
Well, and you did play an instrument in school. I know you wanted to first play the guitar, but you got a violin instead. Tell that story.
That salesman, door-to-door salesman comes by. Actually, he accosts me outside, and he says, "Hey, where do you live, sonny, you know? Do you like to play an instrument?" So he knocks on the door and he tells my folks, we teach any instrument that you want. What would you like to play?" And I said, "Oh, the guitar, of course." And he said, "Well, you know, the guitar is a difficult instrument. You should maybe start with something more simple like the violin." And we were all so green that we bought that.
Right.
You know, come to find out they only taught violin lessons, of course. So I wasted, I can't say wasted, because, you know, it was great pitch training for my ear.
Sure.
You know, just had no interest in the violin.
Well, you played that, but then you also played the organ, too, at some point.
Yeah, after I got through with the violin, my mom let me take piano lessons, and that was also a learning thing that I just didn't feel like I just didn't have the patience for reading one note at a time and playing classical pieces. But finally, after a year or two, she gave me a chord book, and that opened up a whole new horizon for me, because I could realize I could learn three chords and I could play all the songs on the radio. But then I went on a trip with my folks down to Texas, and in the church we were visiting, this lady was playing making these great sounds on the Hammond B3 organ, and so they arranged for me to have some lessons while I was down there. And that became kind of my instrument throughout life.
But it was that, and then, you know, you spent a lot of time as a kid reading Song Hits magazine, and you decided, you know, as you said, to become a radio DJ. So right out of high school, you signed up to go to Don Martin School of Radio in Hollywood.
Yeah. I Day after high school, I went for my 6 months active duty in the Army and got that, did the reserve plan after that. And then I came to, friend dropped me off on the corner of Hollywood and Vine. I had $50 in my pocket. I was 18. And I started going to night classes at Don Martin School of Radio. But I used to, I got a job to, you know, to sustain myself printing record labels. And on the way walking there every morning, I would pass a small recording studio with a theater star marquee that said, come in and see what your voice sounds like, $10. And I just, this was just kind of weighing on me every day as I passed. And finally, I got my nerve up and went on a Saturday and made a demo, and I was hooked from then on. I dropped out of disc jockey school, and I said, hey, I'm going to be a rock and roll star.
But I love this, that you were actually literally making records before you were making records. You were making record labels. But the labels you were making, and I have to say, that has got to be a story itself, because you were printing labels for Chess, Checker, Imperial, Ember, Delphi.
Yeah.
The biggest,
And there were a lot of independents, in the 40s, early 50s, it was kind of like it is now. There are only four or five major labels, and that was it. But when rock and roll started, everybody, all these little independent labels just started popping up like ghost towns in the gold rush, and so everybody was looking for the next Ricky Nelson or Richie Valens or whatever, and so that it really opened up a lot of opportunities. And I had I got a record deal within, I think, 4 months of hitting L.A.
Yeah, with was it Radio Records?
Radio Records.
Yeah.
Rockabilly label, and I guess that's I didn't know it at the time, but I guess that I was a rockabilly singer.
There you go. Well, you recorded songs for years, and you were playing barn dances and other venues. Things weren't taking off that quickly for you, but then you met Curtis Lee.
Yeah, my buddy used to come up to stay with me on the weekends. He was going to school, going to college in Pasadena, and he'd come up. And one weekend, he brought Curtis Lee up. He was his classmate, and he said, he sings good. Can you introduce him to some people? So I introduced him to my record producer manager, and he did make some records with him. And then he got kind of discovered by Ray Peterson, and the co-owner of Dunes Records. And so he got a big break to go back to New York and be a recording artist for Dunes. And soon after that, in the meantime, I'd met Tommy Boyce. Yeah. I met Tommy the same time Curtis met him, actually. And Tommy the break to go back to New York and write for Dunes Records. So I was kind of left alone back in L.A. And they wasn't too long before they had a couple of hits. Curtis and Tommy wrote and Curtis sang Pretty Little Angel Eyes and Under the Moon of Love. And here I was back in Hollywood printing the record labels for their hits and feeling a little left behind.
Yeah. And there was also Be My Guest, I think, for Fats Domino that kind of brought him some notoriety too. But, you finally got that call. Your partnership, made a breakthrough. You got signed up together. And, there was a song called Lazy Elsie Molly by Chubby Checker, and that was in 1964, right?
64. It was our first Boyce and Hart hit. Yeah. I got the opportunity to go back to New York, and that's when Tommy and I actually got serious about teaming up pretty exclusively. And so we got the Chubby record, and then right after that, within a month or two, we wrote Come a Little Bit Closer for Jane the American, so we had a couple of hits that year.
Yeah, and then and among so many others, and then there was Hurt So Bad by Little Anthony and the Imperials, as you mentioned before, Paul Revere and the Raiders. I'm Not Your Stepping Stone. The songs just started rolling about here. Tell me about Dr. Heartache.
Well, Dr. Heartache was kind of the first song where Tommy picked up his ears a little bit that I had written. Because Tommy and Curtis were kind of hanging out. This is before they went to New York, and I was married, so I would see them from time to time. They'd come by and say, "Have you written anything?" And then play them whatever, and they did the same, played me stuff. But one day I played them Dr. Heartache, and Kurt just got very excited and said, "Can I record this?" And I said, "Sure." And Tommy kind of said, "Maybe this is somebody that I could take seriously as a songwriter," and that's when we started to help each other with our songs.
Well, I say you came. You were mentioning you were out in New York. You came back to L.A. But part of this was this whole Screen Gems thing and Don Kirshner. How did you meet Don?
Well, that's how we got back to L.A. We were in New York after we did Closer and the Chubby record. Donnie signed us to it had been Nevins Kirshner Music. It was one of the most successful music publishing companies of all time that he had built with Carole King and Jerry Goffin and Man and Wild and so many others. And he had just sold the operation to Columbia Pictures, and they opened a West Coast office. So he sent us back out here and signed us to Screen Gems Columbia Music. And that opened up a whole lot of doors for us, opportunities. And even though Donnie was he was the big boss, he was on the East Coast, and we had Lester Sell out here. It was our immediate boss and mentor. And so those were the... That's when things started to take off, really.
For those of you who don't know this, you know, you and Tommy wrote, produced, and recorded a large portion of the first season of The Monkees. So how did this all come about? They said, you know, we want to create an American Beatles for television.
That's what they told us when we had our first meeting with Bert Schneider and Bob Rafelson, producers of the show. They were getting ready to do a pilot for to try to sell this show. But like you said, American Beatles on television, and we were thrilled to have that opportunity because the prospect of having a television exposure for our records, that would have been great. So we convinced them we were the guys, and we wrote the three songs they needed for the pilot. And we were told we would be able to produce the records. And so we worked on the thing for about most of a year, 11 months, something like that, before they finally sold the show. And that's when Donnie Kirshner flew out to California and got involved for the first time and said, called us in and said, I know you guys were promised to produce the records, but you've written hits, but you never produced any hits. And I got to go with the big guns on this. So we were off the project and pretty devastated. I mean, this is something we just, is our big opportunity.
Sure.
And we'd planned and we'd formulated and we had the sound all in our heads. So we tried to stay positive and Donnie tried some of the biggest producers of the day and got tapes back that he really didn't like. So at one point we went into his office and we said, here's the deal, Donnie. It's July. It's late July. You don't have any record. The television show is coming on in September. So here's the deal. I've got my band that I work moonlight nights in nightclubs. Candy Store Profits. Let me take them in a studio, a little rehearsal studio, $10 an hour place, and we'll work up some arrangements on two or three songs, and you come down and hear it. It'll only cost you $10,
that's amazing.
You know, an hour of your time. Yeah. If you like it, give us our project back, and if you don't, we won't bother you. So he came down, and he was blown away by the stuff, and he said, you're back on, and you're the producers.
That's absolutely amazing. Now, tell me a little bit about these folks from the backup band. So it was Candy Store Profits. It was a band that you were playing with. Who were some of the guys that were in the band?
Well, it was Jerry McGee on guitar and Billy Lewis on drums and Larry Taylor, who was a founding member of Canned Heat later on, on the bass. And I had been working as a background singer for Teddy Randazzo for about 2.5 years before coming back to California to join Tommy at Screen Gems. So we would work Vegas 12 weeks on, 12 weeks off with Teddy, and then the four of us would come back here and play clubs just to keep the bacon on the stove during those times.
Yep.
And so we were a real band, but then when I came out here to work, the other three guys went to New York and relocated to California just at the right time when we got the Monkees project. So Tommy and I decided we would use a band that we'd both worked with for some time, and it was a real band. And even though most all the other projects that we produced, we would use the Wrecking Crew, the LA studio guys who were great. But we thought for this particular project, let's make it sound like a real garage band, which we were.
Yeah, I was going to say, Last Train to Clarksville, you know, which is one of the first songs, biggest hits of them all, had already been, you know, going up in the Billboard charts for weeks before the first episode of the Monkees even aired, which was September 12th, 66, and then it reached number one, you know, made the covers, you know, you two made the covers of all the music trade magazines.
Right.
Tell me how that whole song came about.
Well, actually, the title was kind of a mistake. I was pulling into my carport one night, punching through the stations, the radio, and I heard just the tail end of Paperback Writer for the first time. It had just been released, and Paul was singing Paperback, and I thought he was saying Take the Last. It was in my head, you know. And next day, I heard the whole thing, and I realized it was a song that had nothing to do with taking the last train to anywhere. But I still thought it was a good title, so I told Tommy, and we needed another song or two for the first Monkey album. So we went in and we kicked names of destinations around and ended up with Clarksville and tried to do a song. It was a veiled war protest song, because we knew we couldn't do an overt one that would be recorded by the Monkees and
right.
be played on national television.
Right.
But it was a song about a fella going off to Vietnam, really, and not knowing if he'd ever come back, and wanting to have at least one more night with his girl.
Yeah. Well, pretty impactful stuff. And, you know, this is something I never understood at first, and I know it happened, is, you know, the Monkees themselves re-recorded their vocals over yours when they were actually released.
They were in the studio. Yeah. They were doing like 12-hour days making those television shows. And so what we'd be in the recording studio at the same time, producing the instrumental tracks and getting the background vocals right and having the whole thing ready, so that when we got, say, Mickey would come over at 10 o'clock at night or something, we would teach him a song on the spot, and he would do a great job, just walked out and nailed it usually, and put his lead vocal on, and we had a finished product. So it really worked well, because just it was really a time restraint thing.
But there was, you know, once people found out that the Monkees really, you know, weren't, you know, producing or, you know, playing their own songs, there was a lot of negative publicity out there, obviously.
It was all manufactured publicity, because from the beginning, you know, the Monkees were two actors who had to learn how to become musicians, and two musicians that had to learn how to become actors.
Sure, right, okay.
And so the two musicians were not happy that Donnie Kirshner was saying what the next single was going to be.
Are you talking Mickey and David, or?
No, the musicians were Michael Nesmith and Peter Tork.
Okay.
And for good reason, you know, they wanted to have input, they wanted to write songs, they wanted to be part of all that process. But it wasn't working that way. It was working the way Donnie had always worked. This is the song you're going to record, and this is who's going to sing it, and this is the next single. So they were resisting that from the beginning. But as they started to gain power, and because they had a hit television show with the network and with their producers of the show, they really started pushing back against Donnie and wanted to take more control, and so. That whole thing about not playing their own no acts in L.A. were playing their own instruments. The Birds didn't play their own instruments recorded, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was not unusual. But Nesmith did an article, an interview in the Saturday Evening Post with Big National Magazine, where he said, "Tell the world that we're manufactured and that we don't do this, and that they've put millions of dollars into this thing." And so he started his campaign that way, a public relations campaign that ended up with him gaining the power to oust Donnie Kirshner.
You know what, though? But through all this, I mean, you were obviously working with Mickey and David and Peter and Michael.
Yeah.
They liked you guys, though. I mean, there wasn't any real true animosity.
No, it's true. They saw, you know, I used to hear interviews with Michael Nesmith and where he would say, "Well, I didn't like any of the Monkey music except for you liked Clarksville, I think." But a couple of people made a film recently, a documentary about Tommy and myself, and it's called "The Guys Who Wrote Them." And they interviewed Michael for that, and I was so surprised to hear the wonderful, nice things that he was saying about us. That he considered us to be part of their team on the West Coast, and it was the East Coast guys that he had his problem with.
Yeah, but I mean, really, he wrote most of their hits. I was looking at Mickey Dolenz, you know, in the foreword of the book that he wrote. You know, to this day, he says, "I always credit them with not only writing many of our biggest hits, but as producers being instrumental in creating the unique Monkey sound that we all know and love." I'd say that's high praise.
It is, and it's very sweet. They were Peter Tork did the same when they interviewed him for that for the documentary. It's time has a way of shaping things differently, and we all come around to appreciating things that maybe we didn't appreciate as we were going through the situations. But they were all very sweet on those interviews, and we had the wonderful privilege that we had two really good singers. Not to say that Michael and Peter were not, but they were in a different genre. They were Michael was really a country folk guy, and Peter was a folk guy. So Michael produced his own cuts in the beginning, but we just thought we'd hit the double jackpot with Mickey and Davey, especially Mickey Dolenz, who I think has one of the preeminent voices of that era for sure.
Sure, sure. Now they were bigger. I mean, for people, I grew up more in the 70s, so I got to see the syndicated Monkees, and that's where I discovered them. Where they of course they breathe new life into who they were and all that. But they were bigger than the Beatles really in the late 60s. I mean they were huge.
The Beatles had stopped touring, and the Monkees show kind of filled that niche, and then they started going. They did learn their own how to play themselves, and went out and sold out stadiums. And I got to go along on those first tours. They asked the Candy Store Prophets and me to back them up on the solo stuff and to open the show with a set before they came out. So I got to see that early Monkey mania there, and it was just like Beatlemania.
Sure.
On steroids.
Sure. And at the time, they were only making, each about $400 a week?
Yes.
That's even crazier.
That's the rumor.
That's crazier. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. The first time I actually... Well, here, let me ask you this. At what point did the Monkees then say to Don, we're done. We want to do our own stuff. We don't need Boyce and Hart anymore. When did things come to an end?
Well, it was an evolution. And as I say, as they gained more power, then things started to heat up, and Donnie flew out with checks for each of them for $250,000 or something like that, and he thought he was going to have this wonderful presentation. And they came over to his penthouse at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and Michael just kind of lost it in the conversation. He said, "We want to have some input. We don't want to just see our records come out and not have never even heard what it was and before the public." And Donnie's henchman, I forget who it was, but the guy said, "Well, I see this contract here. It says that you have nothing to say about it." And Michael put his fist through the wall of the room there and said, "That could have been your face."
Yeah, nice.
So things heated up quickly, and then he got the producers of the show on his side, and they said, "Well, okay, we'll guarantee that you have at least the B-side." And then the next record came out, and they didn't have the B-side. So the producers, it was an interesting situation because Bert Schneider, co-producer of the Monkees show, was the son of Abe Schneider, who was the president of Columbia Pictures. And he's the guy who had bought Nevins Kirshner Music, and he had the power to send Donnie Pack. And, of course, I'm sure they had to pay him a lot of money.
Yeah. So here we are, Bobby, by the end of May of 1967. Seven of the top 32 albums on the charts contained songs written by you. There were 17 in all. Number one LP was More of the Monkees, featured She, I'm Not Your Stepping Stone. Andy Williams, it was number 11. We were looking at all these other charts. You guys were really just bursting out at that point.
They were heady days, weren't they? Yeah. The Monkees changed everything. Yeah. And then when they decided to take control of their own careers, that they were going to produce their own next album, that was actually the perfect timing because Tommy and I had been, we were in all the fan magazines and on the cover of Tiger Beat and all that as the guys behind the Monkees. And so we had then the opportunity to accept some of the offers we had been getting to become recording artists as a duo. And that's what we did with A&M.
Yeah, it was, you went to the deal with A&M. And, it was also, obviously the late 60s, political time of unrest. You wrote songs and performed for so many campaigns, the 26th Amendment. You were national spokespeople for that, really.
We did. We supported Robert Kennedy in his campaign. And we were, of course, devastated when he was assassinated, and then we were asked to become the national spokesman for the Love campaign, LUV, Let Us Vote campaign, to lower the voting age to 18. And that was kind of a real wonderful, fulfilling kind of thing for us, because we had just been so caught up in our own careers and, you know, kind of burst us out a little bit of just looking at our next single and so forth. And we saw an opportunity to work on a cause that we believed in, because it was a time when the Vietnam War had just started to heat up, and the draft was still in existence, and we saw 18-year-old kids being shipped over there to fight and die, who didn't even have the right to vote for the politicians who were making those decisions. So it was something we believed in. We went to Washington, walked the halls of Congress, and got support. And a lot of other people were working on it with us, but we felt like we had made a contribution, and it was just wonderful when we actually got the Constitution of the United States changed.
right.
If we had known, you know, that's what it took in the beginning. I mean, you say, well, how hard is that, you know, change the Constitution?
Yeah, right. But then again, you're at A&M. You got your own contract. You had five charting singles up at the same time. I Wonder What She's Doing Tonight, which was a big hit in 68, over a million copies. You know, got a gold disc and all that great stuff. But this is what always shocked me, is I remember seeing you guys on an episode of Bewitched, of I Dream of Jeannie, like, and you were pretty much, you know, kind of playing who you guys were, but that's when I got to see your face, because I mean, you were more sound to me than visual. And
yeah,
how did you get? Was this through the Screen Gems deal that you were dealing with Columbia at the time? Or
we hired this really unbelievable manager to manage our careers in 1968, and our contract with Screen Gems as songwriters was just coming up for renewal. So instead of going to Lester Sell in the music department, he went over to the lot. Columbia Pictures lot, and dealt with the brass over there, and he came away with a new deal for us. They would give us our own record label, so we'd now record for, we called it Aquarian Records. They would give us, you know, they wanted to sign us to continue to write songs and produce records, but we could also produce other acts for our own label, and they put up a ton of money for that, and they gave us the development deal for our own television sitcom starring Boyce and Hart. So that was the reason that Screen Gems put us on all of the existing shows they had at the time.
And
Flying Nun and all those.
I know, Flying Nun too. That's absolutely hysterical. And you were involved, you know, you toured for years, you were involved with producing music for motion pictures for Columbia, of course. You ended up working with Dick Clark as well many times throughout your career.
We did. We were kind of short order cooks. That's the way we looked at the business as songwriters. Whatever people needed to, whatever act was coming up next, we would say, okay, this is the kind of song for that act and whatever. And then once we got at Screen Gems Columbia, being signed to a music publisher who also, the parent company was a movie studio and a television studio, we got these other opportunities like we did. The Monkees was one example. There was when they sent us over to meet with this older couple named Ted and Betty Corte, who had produced soap operas for their whole lifetime, starting back in the radio days, and they were coming out with a new one called Days of Our Lives.
I know, such an odd trivia point, but yes, you wrote the theme to that.
Yeah. So yeah, we met with them. They said, "Well, we just saw Fiddler, and we love Sunrise Sunset, the song in Fiddler, and could you do something?" It was emotional like that. So
that's awesome.
We did. We tried to, and they hated it. And they said, "Well," we said, "give us another chance." And they hated the second one even more. And we were in a recording studio when we got the word that they didn't like the second one. And Tommy was saying, "Hey, forget this. We don't need to be doing. You know, we didn't know that it was going to be on the air for 50 years."
Yeah, right.
So he said, "Let's just write hit songs." You know, and I said, "Well, okay, but let me, I have one quick idea. I'll go over to the Hammond B3 organ there, and I'll just roll the tape. I'll just play some stuff that sounds to me like the soap opera music I used to hear when I was a kid. My mother was listening to the radio." So that's what I did, and that's what's been on the air 5 days a week for 50 years.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And then I knew in the mid-50s, and then I knew in the mid-70s, you were united with Davy Jones and Mickey Dolenz. It was Dolenz, Jones, Boyce and Hart. Couldn't quite say the Monkees. But that's probably the greatest hits album that I bought in the mid-70s. And you going on tour really kind of put the Monkees in the forefront again.
Yeah, it was a 10 years after they first come out, and they had these kind of little revivals from time to time. Of course, the 20 year one was the big one where they were MTV played their shows nonstop for a weekend or something and introduced them to a whole new generation, and they were the highest touring, highest earning touring act of that year. But at 75 and 76, the four of us teamed up, Mickey, Davy, Tommy, and I. And it was just a ball for a couple of years. We knew all the songs. We played Boyce and Hart songs and Monkey songs. And we had Keith Allison with us who played Raiders songs. And didn't have to rehearse. Davy came up with some soft shoe numbers, and Mickey came up with some comedy. And it was just a lot of fun.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Now, you did mention to me that there was a documentary, The Guys That Wrote Them. When is that going to be released?
I think it's pretty finished. In fact, last night we had a screening at the Grammy Museum, and yeah, it was sold out, and just a preview kind of thing because they're still trying to raise money for some of the licensing of the songs. And
I would think so. That's the most expensive part of releasing any film about music. Absolutely,
but it'll find a home, and it'll be on a cable channel or PBS or certainly on streaming and DVDs, but. Everybody will get to see it at some point.
Terrific. Well, we've been talking to the legendary Bobby Hart. His new book is Psychedelic Bubblegum, Boyce and Hart, The Monkees, and Turning Mayhem into Miracles. It's available at Amazon.com or wherever books are sold. And for more on Bobby, you can visit. They've got an official website, officialboyceandhart.com. Bobby, honestly, thank you so much for hanging out, sharing some great stories with us tonight.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Dave. I hope to talk to you again.
Sounds great, buddy.